Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope it's been an okay week for you all. We had some very lovely news this week. We won an ARIA award, yay! Which, if you don't know, is an audio and radio industry award for best podcast. So over the moon. I actually couldn't go to pick it up because I'm currently in a play about death and cancer, very on brand. So my amazing editor, Kate Holland, went to pick it up at the ceremony in Leeds, and you might not have been there. So you might have missed what I wrote for her to say, and one of the things I wrote for her to say was thank you. So I just want to say it again, genuinely thank you to every single one of you who is listening to this. If it wasn't for you listening and downloading and, you know, doing all the other things that podcasts ask you to do all the time, we wouldn't be able to carry on. So genuinely thank you. We share this award with you, although I probably can't give you the award. There's only one, but in spirit. We also have two live shows coming up on November the 3rd at the BFI in London at 5 p.m. We would be doing a cheery chat about death with Emma Freud and Catherine Ryan. And on November the 16th at 7 p.m, we'll be at the Dulwich Picture Gallery with Jeff Lloyd from Reasons to be Cheerful, Stevie Martin from the Nobody Panic podcast, and Sophie Duca from Channel 4's Riot Girls as well. If you head to the BFI website or the Dulwich Picture Gallery website, you should be able to book tickets, or we have tweeted about them as well on the Griefcast Twitter. This week's guest is comedy writer and podcaster Jason Hazley. Jason is an incredible comedy writer. He has written jokes for Mitchell and Webb, Armstrong and Miller, Screenwipe, Philomena Kunk, the Paddington films, the Ladybird books for grown-ups, just to name a few of the incredible things he's been involved with. Jason came in to talk to me about his dad, who died in 2012. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with comedy writer Jason Hazley. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Jason. I hesitated on comedy writer because you do so much. Like, I'm trying to, if I even started listing, so you do those funny Ladybird books.
Yes.
You've got a new Radio 4 series out at the moment.
Yes.
Called
Agendum.
Agendum. Available on the iPlayer, I'm sure.
Yes.
You've worked on the Paddington films.
Did some rewrites on Paddington 1
like,
and 2.
Yeah. What, like, you do a lot.
I'm busy. Yeah, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah. And you work with Joel Morris.
Joel Morris. Yeah.
But what I like about you guys, one, you're funny, that's nice. But two, I feel like it's nice to see like proper comedy, right? Because lots of comedy's changing at the moment, isn't it? Like it tends to be like maybe a stand-up will write a show.
Yeah.
But you guys like are like genuine comedy writers, I feel. Like you're people who just, you can hire you and you will make things funny.
Well, there's, you know what, there's something, I was reflecting on this because the recent death of Dennis Norden, and Dennis Norden and Frank Muir were basically comedy writers. And then, but the one thing people remember Dennis Norden for is for presenting It Will Be All Right on the Night, you know. Whereas you forget that he wrote hours and hours and hours of comedy, and he wasn't really a front of camera man.
Yeah, well, he was always a bit awkward front of camera.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Yeah. I mean, I think that clipboard was a sort of safety blanket for him, wasn't it?
Are you hoping for your own version of It's All Right on the Night
of
eventually?
Of course, absolutely, yeah. YouTube bloopers or something. No, I've been in front of the camera a few times as well, and it turns out that that's not somewhere I should be either. The first time I ever did it, I asked. We were writing on a series of that Michelin Web look, and I said to the producer, can I have a line in this series somewhere? Just because I thought I'd like to stamp my face on TV because I've written a lot of it. And he said, yeah, of course. So I played there was just some Bond parody. And the opening shot was a camera sweeping across a casino towards some people who were playing, I think they were playing Whack the Rat or something. That was the idea. It was a casino with all the wrong things in it.
Right.
And I was a croupier, and all I had to do was to step up to a table and say, faites vos jeux, messieurs dames. And it was two paces I had to take. And when they said action, I realised that I had forgotten how to walk.
It's hard. Walking and talking is hard.
Walking's really hard.
Yeah. And then talking.
In front of me, anything in front of a camera, it turns out for me, is fucking difficult.
But I'm almost a bit glad, because if you are such a good comedy writer, that if you were also, like, a flawless walker... It'd be too much.
I know, I can't do everything. You know?
Exactly.
You can't walk and write comedy at the same time.
And you have your own podcast, which is Rule of Three.
Yes.
It's a brilliant podcast.
Well, the most brilliant episode, of course, featured Carrie Ad Lloyd talking about improvisation.
No way. She's great.
She's great. We've had so many comments about that episode.
That's very
and
nice.
And rightly so, because Joel and I came away from it so excited, going, fucking hell, we just learnt tons and tons from Carrie Ad. So we shuffled the running order around and hurried it out.
That's very
nice.
The
next episode.
I think I enjoyed it a lot because I think we talked about this on the show. As an improviser, you don't get to hang out often with comedy writers who are very like, you know, writers, not improvisers. And it was quite nice for those two worlds to come together.
Yes.
And help each other understand what the other one does rather than be like, oh, writers think improvisers just, you know, make it up and aren't working, or improvisers think writers are boring, and you know, like to be like, oh no, we could learn from each other. I mean, this is going to turn into Rule of Three if we're not careful.
It's true, yes.
I want to start
yes.
interviewing you about comedy. So, on a not as funny note,
handbrake turn.
Handbrake turn. I know. Sometimes they go smooth, but this is a handbrake turn. Who are we remembering today?
We're remembering my dad.
What was your dad's name?
Keith.
Keith.
Yes.
Keith Haseley. Oh, I like it.
Well, he's Keith Smith, actually, because I was born Jason Smith, but then had to change my name because I was in a band with two other Jason Smiths.
Sorry. Of course you were. Of course.
See how that one works? It's ridiculous. And then I got called in by a film company. A film producer called me in for a meeting and said, I love the music you did for the film Something or Other. And I went, and there's another one. There's another Jason Smith.
This was the wrong one.
So
oh, my God.
I was the wrong guy being called. And I thought at some point, okay, I'm going to start getting credit for other people's work. They're going to get credit for mine. I need to find another name.
Wow.
Which means that I'm not going to be mistaken for anybody else on PRS or something.
Yeah.
So I picked the word Haseley off a bottle of mineral water.
What was it doing on that? For what?
I don't know. I went to a restaurant somewhere and there was a bottle of Haseley Down mineral water. And I thought, I've never heard that word before. It's a tiny village in Hampshire, I think. I thought,
do you know what? All this time, I've always thought, God, what an unusual name Haseley is. It's really lovely.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
It's really nice.
I chose it.
If you can choose your last name.
Yeah, true.
You can choose a nice one. So your dad was just Keith Smith.
Keith Smith,
he didn't enjoy the benefits of a Haseley.
He didn't have a Haseley benefit, no.
No, Haseley benefit. I've got a terrible Haseley benefit.
I'm applying for Haseley benefits. A lot of forms.
Too many, all in wood. naughty. When I'm trying to handbrake turn again.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get out of the car, to be honest with you. Yeah.
His metaphor could run and run.
Yes. When did he die?
He died on the 27th of April 2012.
2012. Okay, and isn't not it, that long ago.
No.
Yeah.
But isn't it odd that one of the things I didn't realise pre-losing a parent is that you suddenly get another date in your calendar.
Yeah,
you go,
yeah.
Ooh, 27th of April's coming up soon, isn't it? You go, oh, I didn't want to... That's a shitty date to remember.
Yeah.
What a thing. But it sits there like one of my kids' birthdays, you know?
Yeah. It's like, it just adds to the list of things you have to remember, don't you?
Yeah.
And do you have this? My anniversary is also April. And so I hate April. I'm really not a fan. Really happy once we get through to May. Like, I really... Unless... Do you have another birthday in April?
No. But I know what you mean. It's...
It just makes me like, oh, God, it's April.
Did you have that thing... I had it in the first year after he died. The two dates I dreaded were his birthday, the first birthday after his death, and the anniversary of his death, because I just thought, oh, this is going to be horrible.
Yeah.
This is going to be really hard to get through. And his birthday was a day after mine. So my birthday that year was a very glum occasion, and I really couldn't do anything with it.
Because you know what's coming tomorrow.
Because I knew that tomorrow was going to be shitty. And it turned out that his birthday was actually better than mine. And then when the anniversary of his death came round, it wasn't what I was expecting. And the takeaway from this, of course, is that grief is not something that runs on a clock, is it?
Yeah,
it's just,
no.
It's weather. It comes and goes.
Yeah.
You know, on my way here today, I checked the weather forecast and it said it's not going to rain. So I didn't put a rain jacket on. And when I stepped off the tube, it was raining. You know, so it's just weather. It comes and goes.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll get pitched into a couple of days of grief for no apparent reason whatsoever. Because there isn't a reason usually. It's just.
No, and there's a lot of people use weather as an analogy. Like I often think like a black, you know, the black cloud or dark cloud or, you know, that kind of like suddenly everything seems foggy. And it's, you know, exactly the same as English people. British people during a summer when they're like, God, it's hot. I didn't expect that. Oh, it's rain. You know, we're always surprised, yet we shouldn't be. And exactly the same with grief. You're always like, what? Why? And you're like, this is grief.
I think it's taken
like 20 years. And now I'm like, oh, yeah, of course, it's come out of nowhere. I don't question it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But that takes a long time.
Ditto, yeah. I think it's very similar to Matt Haig, who is a lovely writer and a lovely man.
Brilliant writer.
Said in Reasons to Stay Alive, he's talking about depression, obviously, but a very similar operating system. He said, depression is the cloud, but you are the sky. And you go, that's a nice way of thinking of it. Yeah.
So you're still there.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a bit crap at the moment.
yeah. But don't worry, the sun will come out.
Yeah, exactly. I know, it's so...
And then you'll be surprised that it's sunny.
God, it's hot, isn't it?
It's hot, isn't it? It's summer.
And we say on the show all the time, like, the first year is it's not that other years are easier, but that the first, it's like your first love, you know, your first death, it's that first time you've been through it. And I agree with you, like the birthdays and the anniversary. And I get a lot of tweets on the Griefcast Twitter of people going, oh, I'm coming up to the first anniversary. Oh my God. Oh my God. And the advice, you know, everyone always piles in with is like, I think the worry of it is always worse. Like the weeks before you're like, oh God, it's going to be so bad.
That's
and then
very
the actual
true.
Day, it's normally kind of quite bland and just sort of happens.
Yeah.
But I think the week before you're like, oh God, it's good. And you have this like the time. Like I'd look at the clock and be like, oh my God, this time a year ago, this time 3 years ago, we were, you know, and you sort of can't help but fracture your life back to that moment.
I know. It was exactly 1 p.m. on the 27th of April.
God,
so at 1 p.m. on the 27th of April, if I'm in the right mood, I'll raise a glass to him. But his... Can I tell you about how he died?
Yes, I was just about to say. Please tell me.
Because I've wanted to write about this, but I've never got round to it. So I'm going to do this here and now, and then never revisit it. I think he was a very stubborn man, and he didn't like going to the doctor.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, I think we all know a song about that. Don't
it's a classic character. Yeah.
Yeah. And he started coughing. And he carried on coughing, and his cough turned into a 24-hours-a-day cough.
Oh, my goodness.
And for 18 months, he refused to go to the doctor.
And he was just coughing all the time?
Yeah, he had to move out of the shared bedroom because he was coughing all the way through the night as well.
And he
had to sleep sitting up, and he wouldn't go to the doctor. He was such a fool. And finally, he was taken by ambulance to hospital. And they said to him, you need a quadruple heart bypass. So he had a quadruple heart bypass.
Wow.
And he rallied for about 3 days and then he started coughing again.
Oof.
And the hospital went, oh, well, you did need a heart bypass, but what's this?
Yeah.
And they couldn't figure it out.
So when they first looked, they were like, oh, ignore the cough. It's
well,
the
he
heart.
Had a massively distended heart. So they had to replace, you
yeah,
know,
that was the, like,
the four
thing.
Valves.
God.
Or whatever they are. I'm not very good on plumbing. So they helped him, but the cough persisted. And eventually he had an oxygen cylinder at home and was sitting there,
yeah.
you know, breathing oxygen, and he couldn't walk very far because it was really debilitating him. And then he started to really lose his breath. So he was taken into hospital, and he lived abroad with my mum. So she rang me, and it was pretty clear that something very serious was wrong.
Okay.
So I got straight on a plane.
Where did they live? Was
Spain.
It far? Oh, right, okay. So not too far, but
yes,
yeah.
Yes, typical
not...
Essex people retiring to Spain. So I went over to see him, and I walked into, he was in intensive care at the time, and he looked terrible because he was wearing a sort of, it was a cross between an oxygen mask and a prison, basically.
Wow.
He had this thing clamped to his face so hard that it was pulling skin back, you know,
oh
because
my God.
It was, for some reason, they didn't want to allow anything other than the pure oxygen to get to him. And he said from behind, it's not as bad as it looked, actually. even though it really did look terrible.
Yeah.
So I imagine it was as bad as it looked. And after a few days, they moved him out of ICU and put him onto a ward. And he was there for quite a while. And I hung around in Spain for a couple of weeks and went and visited him every day. And he had to remain very still. And he had to have oxygen now and then. And he could talk a little bit, but not too much. And he could eat a little bit, but not too much.
Was he still coughing at this point? Or was he just very, like,
occasionally,
weak?
Yeah. Yep, he was
God.
Still coughing. And they still hadn't worked out what was wrong with him.
God, that's... Wow, so you're just sort of in this mystery.
Yep.
He's obviously not right.
Yep.
That must have been really hard as well.
It was very strange. And then he had a really bad night one night, and he asked a nurse for a bedpan... And he needed help to be sat onto the bedpan because he shouldn't move too far.
Yeah.
And he couldn't pass a stool. And then he felt he needed a bedpan a couple of hours later, so he asked the nurse again, and the same thing happened, couldn't do anything. He asked a third time, and she said, no, I'm sick of bringing you a bedpan. And he shat the bed.
Oh, God.
And then the following morning, to... ward orderlies came to give him a bed bath, and they were a bit rough with him, and he started coughing and panicking, and my mum was there with him. It was first thing in the morning, and he was in a real state, panicking, saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. So they slammed him straight down into ICU again and sedated him. So those were the last words he spoke, I can't breathe.
Oh, Jason.
He was then in ICU for a further couple of weeks, I think it was. And at this point, he was no longer ours. He was hospital property.
Mm.
So the hospital would only let a maximum of two visitors in for 1 hour a day at a given time. And everyone had to be wearing, you know, shoe covers and gowns and
wow.
things.
Wow, and so this is in Spain still?
Yeah. Despite my description of what happened to him on his last night of consciousness, the hospital was very good, actually. I just think he got a bad nurse there.
Yeah.
So he was in intensive care then, and one by one, all of his bodily functions were being outsourced to pieces
yeah,
of machinery.
Yeah.
So he was surrounded by hundreds of thousands of euros worth of things that were beeping and hissing and pumping and whirring.
God.
And
yeah.
And we sat and talked to him for an hour a day for a couple of weeks. And at some point after a couple of weeks of this, I thought... I really do feel like I'm surrounded by the stench of death here, and I need to get some... I want to see the living again. So I said to my mum, I'm going home for a few days to see my partner and my kids.
Yeah, because it's very hard when you're in that...
Yeah.
Like, and we've talked about this before, of like, that sense of death is so strong, you feel like you're breathing it in, and it feels like it's taking over you. And
yep.
there's a sort of primeval part of your brain going, like, get out. You can't breathe. You can't breathe here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really... It's hard because obviously it comes with so much guilt because you want to be near them, but at the same time you're like, I know for me to survive, I have to like go and just breathe some air somewhere.
Absolutely,
But it's really, and obviously it's not, you know, that's the nature of ICU and hospitals, but it's hard. I think there's a lot of guilt in, which is understandable, but it's just, it's that sort of, that part of your brain being like, you can't stay here. Like, you can't survive here.
It was a very primal instinct, actually. Yeah. It was a very primal, I've got to be surrounded by the signs of life.
Yeah, yeah. I've got to remember I'm not dying. Because you think, you start feeling you're dying.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're being surrounded by dying.
Yeah.
And there was no question that he was dying by that point. It was absolutely self-evident. My mum was still saying, do you think he'll come back home? And I was going, no, he's not. He's not going to come back now. One of the things I used to do was I took my phone in there and played him one of his favourite songs every day. I chose a different one every day. Just because I've read somewhere, and I've got no idea how you know this, that hearing is the last thing to go.
Yeah, I know, I've heard that
so
too.
I've got no idea. I mean, but I watched the many things that were, the many machines that were attached to his brain for any signs of any change of waveform, and nothing was happening. So I don't think he heard a thing. I even played him his first dance from his wedding.
Aww.
Even that didn't get to him. The dying sod. I went home, and of course he died while I wasn't there. Weird, weird timing for his death as well. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the visitors were let in, and my mum went in to see him. And he had lain still doing nothing now for a few weeks. And he suddenly took a sharp intake of breath and opened his eyes and died.
Wow.
Which I think really traumatised my mum, because it was very, very clearly, this is the moment of death. I think she read his opening of eyes as his acknowledging, I'm dying, that's it, I'm dead.
Yeah.
You know? So I then went back to Spain a few days later, and he'd chosen to leave his body to medical science for research, which is very rare in Spain, because they're quite strictly Catholic.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So his act of generosity was sort of not read that way.
Because they were like, he wants to what? Sorry, that's not what we do. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Also, the hospital were like, to my mum, where's the family? Why aren't the family here?
Oh, wow.
And she said, well, my son's gone back to London for a few days, and, well, you should be here. With a dying relative, you know, there was lots of sense of duty and bollocking going on.
God, that's mad.
I know. Yeah, there you go. Different strokes for different folks.
I guess that's it's very, you know, you are in a completely different culture, but it's funny, isn't it? Like, things like, that doesn't mean I don't, because there's not 20 people here weeping, doesn't mean people aren't sad.
Yeah.
But, of course, that's what they read as sad.
Yeah.
You know.
They read, and as respectful, I suppose.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because
it
would have been respectful, I suppose. I went to the funeral parlour. I said, I want to see him. To say goodbye to him. Turned up at this funeral parlour, which was a huge fucking place. It was very, very Californian.
Wow.
And talked to the guy there, who said, okay, well, we'll lead you into the chapel of rest and you can see your father. I'd done this before, many years ago, when my grandmother died. I went into the chapel of rest where she was in Cornwall, and there she was laid out, looking beautiful and young and lovely and at peace. And I walked into the funeral parlour in Spain, into the chapel of rest, and there was a nice big stained glass window at one end, and at the other end, two orderlies pushed a trolley through a door with a body bag on top of it.
Oh, God.
And I thought, right, okay, because if he's leaving, yes. If he's leaving his body to medical science, course.
They can't do stuff.
They won't
to
do
it.
Anything
yeah.
to it. So
oh,
he's just been
God.
In a fridge, in a bag.
Oh, God.
And they unzipped the top of the bag, and there he was, one eye still open, his nose apparently broken, great marks on his neck where the lines had been attached to him.
Oh, God.
Unshaven. He just looked fucking awful.
Yeah, fuck.
And it really upset me. And I started to feel guilty then about going, fuck, I should have been here. I could have shaved him. You know, just stuff like that, which is sort of cosmetic and irrelevant. You know? But it's the kind of thing that gets you. My mum and sister were there with me, and I'd gone in alone. And so I looked at the state of him and was kind of, I thought, I'm going to hold his hand. I'm going to talk to him. So I said to the orderly who pushed him through on the trolley, could you leave me alone for a few minutes? And he went, well, how long do you need?
Oh, my God.
And it was really, I really felt like we've been terribly disrespectful in some way here.
Yeah.
I couldn't really get into it. I couldn't really understand it. So I had a few minutes with him and spoke to him and told him I loved him, which was more or less true. And then left him to it. And I went out to my mum and sister, who were waiting outside, and one of them, I can't remember who, said, "Do I want to see him?" Yeah. And I said, "No, you don't. No, yeah. You definitely don't."
God, that's so interesting then. So do you think there was a big problem that he wasn't, you weren't sort of doing a Catholic burial, like he wasn't in a coffin and they just didn't quite know what was going on?
I think so. Because, for instance, in the medical system out there, once they've, you know, carved you open and done bits and pieces to you and so on, they then, what's left of you is then given a proper Catholic burial by the hospital.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, in some way or other, this was his decision, let's remember, he was either defying Catholicism or deferring Catholicism in some way, in a way that they didn't like.
Perhaps that normally happens when there isn't a family.
Well, maybe, yeah. I suppose, you know, what do you do when someone, you know, there's no one there to mourn for them? You know?
Yeah, so perhaps it's more common that it's like, oh, okay, he's being used for research because there aren't, and they just couldn't. I'm trying to think of an equivalent, like if someone here was like, oh, we're going to send him to the moon, and you'd be like, okay, so you have to, like, please can you put him in a moon suit? And all the doctors here being like, okay, like, don't you want to... Do you want some family to see him before we send to the moon? Like, I guess they just, you just saw out the
Musk
remit.
Does Mrs. Musk want to wave you long goodbye?
But that's really, it's such a funny small clash of culture, but obviously it has such a huge effect on you and your family.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting because it's like, you know, we forget as a country that isn't predominantly Catholic, hasn't been for a very long time, you know. If you know your history, Henry VIII, guys, I'm not just like being anti-Catholic. Suddenly realise it's
real.
Yeah, it happened. And so when you do go to those countries where, you know, Catholicism is still very present and a very big deal, yeah, it's just that all that other stuff comes with different baggage in the way that we have our baggage, you know.
And you don't, I think I didn't read some of the signifiers.
How
would I know?
Where in your life would you get that lesson of like, if your father dies in a Catholic country, like, who's...
Make sure you're there, for Christ's sake.
But also, I think that, I want to go back to that, because that happens on the show so much, that people say, the moment I left, they died.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so common that I am now convinced that either they want you there, if they want you there, they'll wait for you, and if they don't, they won't. Like, I think it's such a common thing that they don't want the kid, they choose to go when the children
are
around.
I wonder. I mean, obviously we'll never know, but it's a perfectly plausible theory, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's something, it's either a beautiful coincidence or there's something we'll never know as well about the fact that it was when my mother walked in at visiting time, held his hand and he died.
Yeah. I do think that's...
I don't know.
I can only go by the stories that I hear on this, and it often is they often don't want the kids around. It seems, I hear so many stories of the children saying, and now having had kids, I think I get it. I can understand being like, yeah, I don't want you to have to see this. But my wife or my partner, my husband, they're my level. They understand that's different, but I don't want you to have to be there. It's so common that someone goes, literally, like, I went to get a cup of tea. Or I went to go and buy something in the shop. You know, I went back to home to have a bath, and then they fucking call me and they're like, they've died. It's, you know, it's, who knows?
Who knows?
So then your sister or your mum, you said, don't see them. And then did you have a funeral later?
No. So the next thing that happened was, obviously, when you're a body ready to be sent to a research hospital, you have to be got there fairly quickly. And as we left the funeral parlour, a black windowless transit came past us and I went, that's him, isn't it?
Oh, God.
That's him. I know that's him. He's not in a funeral car, is he? He's just in a refrigerated van. Off he goes.
Did you speak to him about this choice?
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I fully supported it. I think it's a great idea, yeah. The thing, of course, it left us with was an absence of a funeral and an absence of a memorial.
So, there's no funeral. They've taken the body.
We had a memorial service back in the UK. And I said to my mum, I'll say something. Because I thought, I'm a writer, I can do this.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
It's a different job.
Wrong.
It's not like writing some jokes for someone.
It's really not writing Philomena Kunk. It's so, good grief. Hardest bit of writing I've ever done. It was only about 800 words. But even then, I had to, for some reason, I had to couch it in terms that meant I was in touch with the writer bit of me. So I even gave it a title. It was called My Father's Nose and Other Features or something like that, you know, because I had to, it had to be a piece of writing.
Yeah, that's the only way you
Otherwise,
process it.
I would just probably lose my shit, you know.
Yeah.
But it was such a hard thing to do. But it was, but it was okay. But I was very conscious as well, because we weren't very close, my dad and I. So I didn't want to write something that sounded like some enormous paean to this wonderful man, because yeah. that wasn't the relationship I had with him.
Yeah.
So I had to make it absolute. I wanted to be scrupulously honest about it. So, you know, I did mention the fact that he was largely an absence of a parent, because he made some odd decisions, like moving to night shift work, which meant that he saw his family for half a day at the weekend, and that was it. And we worked six nights a week the rest of the time. So, you know, there's definitely some, there's something going on there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
This, I don't want to turn this into therapy.
No.
It's mainly because I'm going to therapy, if you ask.
How old were you when that happened?
When
he took night shifts?
I think I must have been about seven or eight, something
like
that.
Oh, wow, young then. Young enough to notice that, kind of like, oh, that's a change.
Yeah.
God, yeah, that's hard. I think it's really, I mean, I have the same, not the same, but like, because our relationship wasn't perfect, I never want people, like, when people are like, oh, it's so sad, and you're like, yeah, it is, but it's not just sad, like, it's more complicated than that, like, you know, it wasn't like, oh, my dad was such a great guy. It's like, I get annoyed by that, because, like, it's just, is anyone have that simple relationship with their parents, really?
I don't know.
They must be happy people.
You do get...
Some people do. I've had some
people say, my mum is my best friend, and every bit of me goes, that doesn't sound right. it sounds like there's something missing there. Not missing from you or your mum, but missing from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on there? Can I tell you the two best things that were said to me the period after he died? I'm going to have to use names here. So okay. This is not me name dropping. This is because they are both a great credit to the people. Kevin Elgin, who's a very good friend of mine, kept in touch with me the whole time my dad was dying, almost on a daily basis.
Wow.
Just dropping in saying, how's he doing?
That regular contact makes such a difference, doesn't it?
God, it's a fantastic thing to do. But he is a fantastic and staggeringly compassionate human being. He really is a brilliant man. When he died, he sent me a message saying, he did some good things, your dad. And I thought, that's weird, Kevin, you've never met my dad.
Yeah.
Like, what made you say that?
Yeah.
And of course, it didn't take me long to realise, oh, he means me. What a lovely thing to have said.
Yeah,
so thank you, Kev. And the other thing was, and this was just brilliant, I was in a pub in Shepherd's Bush with a few people, one of whom was Carrie Quinlan.
Oh, who's also been on the show.
The wonderful Carrie Quinlan. And I was talking to her about it, and she had lost her dad, I think, about 2 or 3 years before me. And we were talking about it, and she put her hand on my elbow and leaned in and looked me straight in the eyes and went, it's shit, isn't it? And I went, yeah, that's the most accurate thing anybody is going to say to me about this. You're right. It's shit.
Yeah.
It's just shit.
It's shit. It's really shit.
Grief is shit.
Yeah.
Death is shit. It really is.
Yeah, it is. And I think so often, like, again, like, people are like, oh, why do I feel so bad? You're like, because someone died. Like, because that's what happened.
Do you remember the death that happened? Yeah,
so
that's
why. You feel shit. Like, and this kind of, this kind of cleansing of it all being kind of like, well, and this and that voice and all of this. It's like, no, it's shit. It's really shit. That doesn't mean good things can't come out of it or that you won't be okay. But it is shit. Like, that has to be acknowledged first and for all, that it's shit. It's just really shit. And if someone said, do you want this door? Well, you don't have to deal with it. Or this door, you do. You'd be like, oh, the one where I don't have to deal with it, please. That sounds great. That's fine. But, you know, that's life and all the rest of it. That's weather. That's just what happens. And grief, I think, is a very slow acceptance that sometimes things are very shit and there's nothing you can do about it. Like, that's all really the process of grief is. It's just taking tiny, tiny steps and going, oh, sometimes it's raining.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
At the memorial service, I put an announcement of his death in the local paper in Chelmsford, where he was a postman, and I'd also rung the sorting office where he worked and said, "Look, can you stick a notice up saying there'll be a memorial service here?" So a load of postmen turned up to the memorial service, and what was dead touching was that they started talking to me about my dad, and they were describing a completely different man from the one I knew.
Wow.
They were describing this very sociable, very compassionate, very hard-working, standing up for people in the workplace. He was never like that with his family.
It was
a very, very different person being described to me, which I was pleased that they had fond memories of him, but I was also very confused because I thought, he didn't bring it home. Why didn't he bring that home? He could have brought that home with him.
But again, it's a slightly generational thing, isn't
it? Yeah, oh, very much, yeah.
It's so like now, there's such a blurring of work and home and you would never keep them separate. I think so many people are like, no, you know, I am who I am and this is what I do. And so it's that my home is as important as my work. But yeah, I've heard that before, of people just being like, that's not the person I knew.
No.
And it's really weird, isn't it? Like,
I mean, my dad was a racist, right? And he would confess to it. He would say, yeah, of course, I am racist, yeah. And when he retired, I surprised him by turning up at his retirement drinks. And he introduced me to his best mate, Dave, who was a 6'6" black guy. And I went, I thought, my dad doesn't, I don't think he understands racism here, because this is his best mate.
It's really, did you find that hard then to kind of reconcile in terms of grief with like the man you were grieving? Did you feel like, I guess, well, we all have that, don't we? Did you kind of, you have that moment and you think, oh, I wish they were here so I could just fucking ask, well, what's that about?
Why
are they all saying this? Like,
yeah, there were lots of people who gave me different recollections of him, which all of which were describing a different person. Even my sister, I talked to my sister about it, and she was talking about a couple of conversations she'd had with him, and I first of all thought, that doesn't sound like him, and then realised that she probably was giving an accurate version of events. It's just that he would never have had that conversation with me, you know.
Wow.
Are you older
than her?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right, so it's like oldest boy, father-son thing.
But then, you know, the thing is, I was very ill as a kid. I had very bad asthma. In fact, I nearly died at the age of 10 months.
Oh, wow.
And I think that might have, therefore, he and possibly my mum as well might have associated me with kind of stress, you know, because it must have been pretty horrible. They were told at some point at about 3:30 in the morning, a doctor came to them from seeing me and said, "Have you had him baptised?" And they said, "No." And he said, "We'd go and get it done at the chapel now."
Oh, my God.
Because he thought I wasn't going to make it through the night. And in a curious theme of being short of breath, what my dad died of, by the way, is something called pulmonary fibrosis,
right,
which is growth inside the lungs. Extra tissue grows inside the lungs, meaning that the capacity of the lungs becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and the body fights for air by coughing. So how he eventually died is basically he drowned.
Oh, my God.
Pretty grim death.
Yeah.
Good job he was sedated, really.
Yeah, you know,
frankly,
in a funny old way, yeah.
But then, about a year and a half, I think, after he died, my son, who was probably 4 or 5 at the time, something like that, got very ill with a sudden shortness of breath.
Oh, wow.
And it dialed up a lot of bloody feelings, seeing him sitting there fighting for breath.
Yeah.
So I stayed home with him, and he had a day off school, and he got worse and worse. And eventually he said to me, "Daddy, am I going to die?" And it's the single most upsetting thing that's ever happened to me is hearing a four-year-old child say that. And of course, he wasn't. He was rushed to hospital and they jacked him full of steroids. And the next day he walked out absolutely fine with the hospital going, "We've got no idea what that was." But boy, did it dial up some stuff.
Yeah, wow. Of course. Of course. It's just all... Even without your dad, that would dial up some stuff,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Plus, it's those triggering things. Like, you know, we talked about this before, like, anything cancer, I'm like, ooh, someone near me or anything that happens to me, I'm like, oh my God, is it cancer? Am I dying? Is that what's happening? Because that's what happened to me. You know, my therapist is always like, you know, well, lots of times you're fine. I'm like, yes, but the one time it really mattered, like, you know, my dad, and he wasn't fine. So yeah, anything that, I think the illness that touches you, like you said, that thing and the fact that you had asthma and then your son not being able to breathe, suddenly that becomes like, I know what that means.
Yeah.
Like, again, it's primeval. Your body has learned something really, really deep of that's bad. That's the bad thing.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to run.
And it's scary. Obviously, it's scary not being able to breathe properly.
Oh, yeah, it's really...
And it's really panicky.
It's so horrible. I used to have asthma, actually. It's gone, but my family have loads of asthma and it's a really horrible, horrific when you just literally, and you're trying and you just can't take it in.
And then
you panic and you produce more adrenaline because you're like, oh God, oh God.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, normally need that one drug and you're fine. So God,
Ventolin is a wonderful thing.
Oh my God, it's incredible.
God. I didn't have that when I was a tiny bairn though. So when I used to have asthma attacks as a very small child, I used to have a suppository of a drug called aminophylline. So
Whoa.
Not only was I lying there, not able to breathe, but someone had to put their thumb up my arsehole.
Sorry.
I deserve some good luck.
That is bloody awful.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
So
the other thing about asthma, of course, and this is true of any shortness of breath, is not only is it frightening for the person, but it's also frightening to see.
Yeah,
it's frightening
it's really
to witness
frightening.
People not able to breathe. It's a horrible fucking thing.
It's really, really horrible. Yeah, I suppose because like with cancer or stuff, you can see pain, but you can't be like, oh, they can't breathe.
Mm.
Like you need a doctor to be like, oh, their liver is failing. You're like, oh, is it?
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, that breathing thing, you're like, I can see it and I know, I can imagine how that feels very clearly. So did you, after Morozov, did you have like a headstone or, you know, did you do anything for him?
He didn't want anything.
Oh, right.
My mother planted something in her garden in memory of him. I wanted something, though, because I found on the first anniversary of his death, when the clock came round to 1 o'clock, and I decided to raise a glass to him, poured myself a little scotch, and then thought, I've got nothing to chink this glass of scotch with.
Yeah.
So I bought an old post box from an architectural salvage place and had it put in the back garden so that I could go up to the post box and toast it.
That's adorable. That's so nice.
Well, it's a bit silly really as
no,
well, isn't
I
it?
I don't but, think that's silly at all. I think that's beautiful. I think that's genuinely one of the most beautiful things I've heard.
Never got any birds nesting in it. I mean, I thought this would be great, you know. I'll see a bird coming out of the letterbox one day and go, oh, we've got a bird's
nest. Maybe it's
nest
too low. Maybe you need to build it up with some leaves. Because, like, they might be a bit afraid. It might be too deep for them. Like, their bird instinct might be like, we might not get out. So I think, can you open it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I would open it and I'd put loads of leaves and sticks to raise it a bit. And then they might be like, oh, all right.
Good. I came here for bird box advice, actually.
One of the weird things that people don't know is, like, I know some stuff about some birds, guys.
Do you? Are you a bird?
I'm not a twitcher, but my mum's very into the garden.
Ah.
So yeah, like, again, same, like, grew up and she planted a tree for my dad. But like years later, we didn't have anything for years either. As I said, the stories I always say, he was in the wardrobe. His ashes were in the wardrobe for about 10 years. And then eventually when we did spread them, it was in Wales. So yeah, I don't have somewhere we can go or anything like that. But
it's weird that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to think that graveyards are faintly ridiculous places. But then you realise, no, actually, these are really important. These aren't, you know, idea of interring the dead is faintly absurd. But the idea of having a focal point is perfectly logical.
Having, it's what you would now describe as a safe space.
True.
For somebody
yes.
to go and grieve.
Yes.
And, you know, you can't do that in the supermarket, but in a graveyard, and it's quiet and respectful and calm. And I feel very, I feel funny. You know when graveyards are sort of, you know, when you can see, like, a bit's gone awry.
Mm.
Like, you know, the tombstone's fallen over or some trees have got involved. And I get really, like, oh, that was once so important to someone, and now, like, there's... And I get it, it's the process and it's expensive and councils can't fix everything, but it does make me feel like, I don't know. I suppose I just hope, well, no one is alive anymore for that to matter, and maybe that's okay.
No, it's strange that, isn't it, when the, you know, the people really for whom the grave was the benefit are no longer there.
Yeah. Or when you walk over something.
It's strange, though. You know, I was, a few years ago, I was doing some family tree research and I wanted to find my great-grandfather's grave and my paternal grandmother's grave. And I found my paternal grandmother's grave in Ilford, in the most wrecked, vandalised, fucked-up graveyard I've ever seen. It was in such a pitiful state.
Oh, no.
And then I found my great-grandfather's grave, and he died out in France during the First World War. So his is in one of the Commonwealth Grave... what are they called? The Commonwealth Grave Commission, something like that, in one of their graveyards. And I found it. It was a really hard one to find, but they are perfectly kept.
Wow.
And, I mean, the reverence with which they treat you know, the dead armed forces is fabulous. It really is.
Do you and your sister talk about it still? Do you feel...
Not very often, no. I still ring my mum on the anniversary of his death, obviously, because she... probably has the hardest time of it.
Yeah.
They got married on her 19th birthday, and he died when he was, how old was he? 68,
I
think.
Wow. So that old.
Just so they'd only really known each other, you know.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, which is a very, so for one half of a partnership that long to disappear permanently.
It's really hard.
Leaves a hell of a hole, I think. She then started to become him.
Oh, really?
Yes, she started to take on his responsibilities and started to do things like build walls and mend fences and consequently do things like drop breeze blocks on her toes and things like that.
Great.
So she started... she thought she ought to do some of the things that he did.
It's like, Mum, get some people in.
and she was always complaining about, you know, bits of wiring or the pump for the swimming pool. You never wrote this down, Keith. You never told me what order you're supposed to do the valves in, you know. Oh,
well, yeah, we talk about some of communication, jobs that you do, especially in a partnership that long, it's just done, isn't it? It's just like, oh, you do that and I do that, and I don't tell you what I'm doing. But it's important to check in with your partner.
Yeah.
What do you do that I have no idea about?
I achieved a tiny little bit of closure.
Oh, yeah.
When I read a book a couple of years ago called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Catelyn Doughty, and she worked for many years backstage at Crematorium in San Francisco.
I've heard of this.
And it was a book all about what goes on behind that door that you don't go through.
Oh, wow.
And it gave me a little bit of relief because I'd always been struck by how shit my dead dad looked.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
With his broken nose and his one open eye and not shaved and in a terrible fucking state. And it was only when I read that book that I realised, oh, of course, you can't do anything to him if you're taking him off for medical research, can you?
Yeah.
And she goes further. She describes what they do to corpses to make them look so good. Because she said the biggest phone call, the most regular phone call we got at the crematorium was someone going, why have you charged me $500 just for looking after my relative? And the answer is because you've got no idea what we have to do to make them look all right for when you come in to see them. They do a lot. I'm not even going to describe what they do. I think you should read the
book
because it's pretty fucking horrific.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Yep.
You know, you leave a bit of cheese out too long, it doesn't look good, does it? Like, you know, a human body, you've got to do a lot of stuff to that to make that okay.
But it's things like, I will give you one example.
Sure,
But a slightly one on the nicer end of the scale is because your eyes sink when you die.
Okay, I'm literally closing my eyes immediately,
they have to put like little contact lenses, if you like, the little arch bits of plastic under the eyelid so it looks like you've still got two eyeballs.
Whoa.
And then, of course, they have to glue the eyelids shut, don't they?
Whoa.
And there's a list of things like this which are sensational. It's a very good book. I recommend it. But
see, that's why I'm
buyer beware.
I'm all for not... Well, we talked about this on the live show, actually. Like, you know, some cultures have open caskets and that's really important, you know, and that's really important for them. I don't think it's a bad thing to see a dead body. But, yeah, with my dad, I saw him after he'd died, but I didn't... you know, after then the hospital dealt with it and he was in a coffin and that was the end of it, you know. And I'm
so was he still in the bed when you saw him then?
Yeah, because he died in a hospital, yeah. Like, and we were there, and because it's cancer, it wasn't like there wasn't any machines, they were just waiting for him to die.
Really?
So, yeah, like, because they just take everything out because they're like, this person is dying.
Is it just reduced to palliative care? Is it just yes. painkillers then?
Yeah, so he must have been on morphine and I think there was like a drip with something in, but he didn't, I mean, obviously he was, it depends on the person, but he didn't end up in ICU and he didn't end up on a ventilator or anything like that. It was just like, this person's very slowly dying and we're just, yeah, waiting. Yeah. So he was in a hospital bed and we were around him and, yeah, so I remember there not being, like, it didn't feel like there was lots of tubes or anything like that. Mm. It felt like it was just, I mean, obviously he looked awful, looked like he was fucking dying. And, yeah, and like their body is shutting down, but they don't give them any food or fluids because they want them to die.
Yeah.
So I remember my brother saying that of like, you know, he needs water. And they have like this horrible, it's not horrible, it's they like a little cotton bud you can put to moisten their lips because everything gets really dry. I remember my brother saying like, you know, we need to give him water. My mum being like, no, we can't. Like the point is we're trying to help him die. Like we don't. I remember at the time being like, what? Like, whoa, oh, what? That doesn't sound like, what? Okay, but.
Is this what we do?
Yeah, but then it's, now I'm very appreciative that my mum was very calm and understood what was going on. And so me and my brother were obviously much more, you know, much more younger, much more like, but the, like.
Because you were about 14.
I was 15, yeah. I was 15, so my brother was 19. My mum was amazing. Like, my mum is amazing, and she's very good in stressful situations. Like, you know, like, you definitely want her around with something when the shit kicks off. She's like, got it. East End Essex lady. And so she just was very calm and was like, yeah, this is what happened. And when he did the death rattle, which if they're not on ventilators, this rattle starts happening because it's the fluid filling their lungs. And again, my brother was like, what was that? Why was that? I just never said anything. I was like, And she said, oh, it's the death rattle. He's dying. You know, and I was like, okay. Like, which, again, I still to this day, I have said to her, like, how did you know that? She's like, I don't know. You just know it. Like, it's just things you know. I was like, well, now I know. So, yeah, it was a very different experience. So I saw him dead. I saw him die and I saw him dead. But and also because cancer, he was so, like you said, he was already in a terrible state. He didn't, much thinner and almost yellow and, didn't look, like you say, that kind of like, oh my God, my dad looks like not a well person at all. So, I mean, you know.
Which was very accurate.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I could be. I diagnosed that straight away. Guys, this guy is bad. So, yeah, but I know what you mean. I think it's interesting that you saw him like that because I'm sure it must have been deeply traumatic.
It was horrible.
In another way, you know, they have this huge thing now in psychotherapy that you need to see the body and it really helps get the closure.
Yes, it does.
And it also helps you understand why he made that choice.
Like
you said you read that book because you were trying to figure out what was happening. So in a way, it sort of led to understanding that process a bit more, I suppose.
Yes, it did. Yeah, I suppose. But it's a very different thing from seeing someone in, like my grandmother in the chapel arrest, where she'd been looked after, you know,
she just looked
great, you know, that was really lovely because I just thought, oh, Nan, you look great, you know. I did come out and say to the funeral director at the time, she looks fantastically well, doesn't she? Even though she was stone cold and waxy, you know.
I don't think I've seen one done.
Have you not?
No, I don't think so. I've seen a lot of dead bodies, but not, like, I've seen fresh.
Fresh?
Fresh dead bodies.
But you haven't seen...
No, I don't think so.
One that's been iced.
No, not an iced cake.
No. The other thing that's... I was going to jump off with this. I had a few thoughts about before coming here, and I was going to jump off with this point, but we may as well do it now.
Yeah, sure.
Which is the verb died.
Mm.
He died. Because as someone like me who constantly thinks about the weight of words and things, I go... So it's something that is an active verb.
Yeah.
And I think dying, it should be passive. It should be something that happens to you, not something you do.
He died.
He
was died, yeah. Mm. Well, I think I said this in Ashling's episode that only recently in therapy, my therapist pointed out that I always say, when I was 15, my dad died. I very rarely say he's dead. And I find he's dead still quite tricky say. Yeah, because he's died sounds active. Sounds like
and
he's
it's
doing
an event
it.
In the past.
It's an event. He's doing it.
Whereas
he's
still
dying.
Dead now, isn't he?
Yeah, dead. That sounds very final to me. It makes me feel like, oh, I'm sorry. What is he? He's not dead. He died.
Yes.
Like, and like she pointed out to me, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm still clinging on to like him doing something. You know, he did this. Yeah, he's doing it. Yeah, I agree with you. The died is. Maybe it's a sneaky helpful word because you sounds active and it makes you feel like they kind of did it rather than like it happened to them. Perhaps that's why it's evolved that way. I don't know.
I can't work out whether it is an active or a passive thing. I don't know whether you die or whether death happens to you.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
I suppose I'll find out one day.
One day. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose I just feel like dead is just, to me, is like, it's, to me, dead is a full stop and died is a comma.
Yes, because someone can die and then things go on.
Yeah.
Can't they? And they do. And that's weird. Did you have this as well? The peculiar thing when I got the news, my mum rang me. I was sitting outside the festival hall where I used to work with Joel, having a sandwich in the days when I ate bread, before bread started to hate me. I was eating a sandwich and she rang and said he died. And so I said, okay, I'll pack up my stuff and get a plane over and put this rest of this sandwich down, which I suddenly wasn't in the mood for.
Yeah.
And had that strange feeling of looking around at everybody and going, everything's just carrying on, isn't it? Everything's just carrying on.
It's so weird.
Now I've got to carry on.
You feel like there should be like a Batman signal in the sky of like, someone just died. Everyone stop smiling immediately. Put on your black clothes.
Or can we just have a big Matrix freeze
for
a minute?
Yeah.
Can everyone just stop for a minute?
There's nothing
weird. While this sinks in.
I used to find that when you'd see like children running and laughing and you're like, how are they acting like nothing's happened? You know what I mean? Something very, anything full of life when you've had that death suddenly feels really, especially on the South Bank, I can imagine that must have been really weird with people just running and laughing at the joy of London.
Yep, like, arts and culture, fab,
fuck
fountains.
So you then just went straight back on that plane. That must have been a strange journey back to Spain.
Yeah, it was. I don't really remember much about it, actually. I don't remember much before going to the funeral parlour, Frank. By the way, the funeral parlour in Spanish is a tanatorio, which is a thanatorium or death building.
Wow.
Thanos, death, Greek, isn't it? Tanatorio.
Oh, my God. That's...
A deadarium.
Oh, God. That sounds like a really awful bit of London Zoo, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Don't go into the deadarium, kids. Is no,
it's not
just
nice.
Go straight to the reptile
it's for,
house.
It's for some of the smellier grown-ups.
Yeah. It's not good. Yeah, I mean that's very common as well. It all being a blur. And so, how do you feel about your own mortality now? Do you feel more aware of it or more okay with it? Like, are you thinking of donating your body? Would you do that?
I've left. I'll tell you what I did do last year is both my partner and I wrote wills because I thought, God, I've been getting around to this. I've been thinking it for years. And when it got to the bit about what happens after my death, I just went, I'm going to leave all the plans up to whoever inherits the problem, basically, because I thought, it's not for me, is it? The funeral is for the people who come, so organise it however you like. You know, do what you like. I don't really mind what happens to what remains of me after death. It doesn't matter by then anyway.
Yeah.
But mortality, I have thought about. Yeah, I had a weird experience that a couple of years ago, which genuinely got to me for some reason. I was back in the early mid 90s. I struck up a friendship with a female actor. When we did a show together, and we hung out a bit and got on rather well. And at some point, we ended up in the same bed.
Sure.
I concluded that was a mistake, and I'm not sure whether she did. I think she probably did as well. But anyway, it meant that we didn't really speak to each other very often after that. And for some reason, I was thinking about her a couple of years ago. I thought, I wonder where she is. I wonder how she is. I'm going to look her up. So I Googled her and all I could find out was about some TV shows she'd been in years ago and just couldn't really find any trace of her at all. And I mentioned to a friend of mine, I said, you know, how do you find someone? And he went, well, I'm an investigative journalist. I'll find her if you want me to find her. So I said, yeah, go on, because I'd love to be in touch with her. I'd found an old phone number for her and tried that and got nothing. And he rang me at some point and he said, okay, do you want to know? So I went, oh, right,
yeah.
What's up? And he said, I'll send you a copy of her death certificate.
Wow.
I went, oh, she died. And she was about, I think she died aged about 38. And not in a not nice way as well. But it sort of got to me because I thought that's the first person I know who I've had sex with who has died. So I've done the most living thing you can do with someone who is no longer living. And it was a really weird dissonance. Like, it took me a few days to sort of work through it and pick it to bits. Even now I'm struggling to articulate it.
Yeah, because
it's such an odd feeling of going, but we were in bed together.
Yeah.
And now you're dead.
Well, it's that thing as well of aging, isn't it? It's just like, oh, I see. Like, that's because I think when you're, you know, under 25, these things to most people are like impossible to even conceive. And you start realizing, oh, death is near. Death is always near.
Yeah.
And we just treat it all the time like it's not. And so, you know, I didn't feel like that because my dad died when I was 15. My dad is dead. I'm getting better at it. But like I felt like death was so present, and that's why, you know, I had suffered terribly from anxiety, and because it was like, it's too close to me.
Yeah.
But I would see other people and be like, it's like me saying I've been to Moomin Valley to you. Like, it's like, well, where's that? It doesn't exist, you know? And you're like, it's real. Why are you all acting like it's not real? And I think that's the thing, when someone young or your age or you've had sex with, you're like, but how can they be dead? That means I'm gonna die.
Like, I suppose it is a reminder, isn't it? There was a page that that we wrote in the Ladybird Book of the Midlife Crisis about was it the midlife crisis or was it the husband? I can't remember anyway. I think it was the husband, about how as he gets older he starts to make little noises. He he sighs as he gets out of chairs and pom-poms as he walks from room to room. This is to remind himself that he's still here.
Yeah.
And I wrote that. I really enjoyed that gag. And then comparatively recently, I stuck on a Tom Waits album I hadn't listened to for a long while, Alice. And there's a song on that called I'm Still Here.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, I think I must have dialed that up for it, because it is about
feeling
like you don't exist. The lyric goes, you haven't looked at me that way in years, but I'm still here.
Oh.
And you go, oh, fuck, he can write, can't he?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great tune. It absolutely folds me in half every time I listen to it, though. Can I read you something
Edmund
said?
Oh, the amazing
said,
Neil Edmund.
The amazing Neil Edmund. I was reflecting on Facebook on the anniversary of my dad's death, I think. I was reflecting on how I felt the years since he died were time that he wasn't going to get back, as well as time that I wasn't going to get back. And Neil Edmund said this, which I think is just brilliant, so I've written it down.
Good.
He said, it's so difficult to avoid their defining characteristic being deadness. My dad never really thought of himself as dead, but that's how we all think of him now.
I love Neil. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met.
He really is. He really
that's
is.
Brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. That reminds me of when I once said to Ken Campbell, name dropping, he said something,
jealous.
What does your dad do? Or something. I said, he died. And he went, they have a habit of doing that. And I thought, that's the best thing anyone had ever said to me about a dead dad. Like, just went, they have a habit of doing that. And I thought, they fucking do.
They do.
Like, they do. Yeah. Well, on that note, Jason, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Keith and all things death related. I really appreciate
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. You can listen to Jason's excellent comedy podcast, Rule of Three, wherever you get your podcast from. And you can follow him on Twitter at Jason Hazley and see his work everywhere. But as a tip, his very good Radio 4 series, Agendum, is available to buy now if you missed it on iPlayer, and is well worth a listen. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, or email thegriefcast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, please do rate, review, subscribe it, all the things we always ask you. It does genuinely help other people find the show and allows me to keep making it, so thank you if you've done that already. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.